as it learns the senses-shattering truth of how they stole Fraser's brain.
Yes, that's right, it's They Stole Fraser's Brain, not quite live, from the secret lab far underground. I'm Tony Fraser, movie critic, science fiction writer, and near genius, and this is our inaugural hour, as if there's anybody else in the room here. I'm all alone in the secret lab, believe me. This is the first pod test cast thing. So I already did one, but it was horribly dull, and so I decided I'd try something different and just kind of start out by explaining, you know, who I am and where I came from, because science fiction fans nowadays don't really have any idea how good they have these kids today. They don't have any idea how good they have it. When I started out as a fan, it was in the mid-70s. I kind of was a fan of monster movies and stuff before that, but the thing that really triggered my interest in fandom, so to speak, was when our local station started taking the syndicated reruns of Star Trek, and this was in the mid-70s, and you just have no idea what a different time it was, because basically, you know, as the song says, any love is good love, so you took what you could get. You would watch a good show like Star Trek, and then when they came out with a new show, even an utter piece of crap like Space 1999, you know, Gerry Anderson, you know, made his entire career on the fact that he could get paid for stuff, for doing really bad versions of stuff that people were just starving for. You know, first he did this absolutely incomprehensible piece of vehicle porn called UFO, and I call it vehicle porn because so much of it is just endless shots of the vehicles launching. You spend like half the episode watching the same four vehicles launch because that was the only good thing about the show. And then he moves from that to Space 1999, which was, you know, just utter crap. About, if you're not familiar with the show, it was about there was a base on the moon, and they had an explosion, and the explosion knocks the moon out of orbit, and the moon goes flying off through space at apparently just, you know, hyperlight speeds, because every week it's running into a different alien civilization somewhere out in space, and they're constantly running into what Starlog magazine called the MUF, the Mysterious Unknown Force, where they would, and they had these little, almost like cargo trucks called Eagles that they would fly over to whatever they happened to be passing close to, and they'd fly over there in the little Eagles, and then they'd fly back, and it was a real piece of crap. Totally boring. So that's why Star Wars was such a revelation. It's not that it was such a good movie, but it was the only movie out there that was really speaking to fans at that time. And so, you know, it is a good movie, and it actually features some emotion and not just mysterious unknown forces every week, but the fact is that Star Wars had that summer all to itself, because there were a whole bunch of us who were literally eating garbage like Space 1999, and then when Star Wars came out, we just jumped on it, and then when Close Encounters came out, we jumped on that too. And that was when the studios realized that they had something that they needed to get hold of. This is why you could have TV show pilots that were being released as movies, because both Battlestar Galactica and the Buck Rogers pilot got released to theaters as motion pictures, not because they were any good, but just because the studios were caught so flat-footed by the success of Star Wars. They didn't have any other product in the pipeline except for, you know, there was Close Encounters, and then there was one really crappy Canadian movie called Starship Invasions, which, I don't even want to talk about that. It starred Robert Vaughn and some hot chick, but it was really bad. anyway, to give you an idea of just how desperate we were back in those days, and just how hodgepodged everything was, because you would literally just kind of latch on to whatever was around you. I went to my first science fiction convention in the summer of, I want to say, 1976. It was a Multicon, was what it was called. And the guests of honor were George Takei from Star Trek, and Brett Morrison, who had been one of the voices of the Shadow on the radio. And they announced, this is how small the community was back then, they announced that both of the guests of honor were going to be signing autographs in the middle of the dealer's room. And it was literally like in the center of the dealer's room. And there wasn't enough of a line, you know, to create an unmanageable crowd, which, you know, to imagine trying to do that today. So here's George Takei from Star Trek, and I am such an incredible Star Trek fan. There's no way I'm going to leave this place without getting his autograph. But I literally have nothing for him to sign, except the only thing in my hand was a magazine that I bought called FXRH, which was a little independently produced magazine about the special effects of Ray Harryhausen. A brilliant little magazine, exhaustively researched. It was awesome. But, you know, here I am, 13-year-old newbie fan, and I'm talking to the star of you know, one of the most legendary science fiction shows of all time, and a star of old-time radio, and I'm asking them to sign this magazine cover, which has nothing to do with either one of their careers, and it's a, you know, a tribute to their professionalism, and once again to the smallness of the hobby at the time, that they were very gracious about it, and you know, didn't give me. You know, they kind of gave me a curious look and asked a question, like, are you sure you want us to sign this? Because it had nothing to do with us. But they signed it, and I still have the guts of the magazine, but I think the cover's been long lost now. So, c'est la vie. La vie! And, you know, then along came the 80s later, after Star Wars had kind of proven that there was a market for science fiction and stuff, and then in the 80s, when you had the flood of business school graduates who came out to basically, you know, the 80s is when you started having all these niche publications, and really you started having marketing reaching into every single type of hobby known to mankind, because you had a whole bunch of business school graduates with nothing to do, looking to make a quick buck. And so that's when science fiction really, really opened up and got mainstreamed as a field. And that was when, you know, that was when we started having a lot more science fiction movies, especially after Star Wars had proven that the effects were feasible. And you had, you know, at the same time, they were starting to ship in Japanese animation, and you know, Japanese animation before then was kind of a, kind of, it wasn't a prestige thing, let's put it that way, but we started getting some of the good Japanese series, and that started to build its own sort of fandom. And now, you know, now we're in this world where you can literally, you know, it's not just that you can go to a corner video store and have your pick of hundreds of science fiction and horror films. You don't even need to leave your room. It's not that you can go to a Walden Books and have shelf upon shelf upon shelf of Japanese comics, and as well as science fiction novels. But you know, now you can literally sit at your desk, never get up from your chair, and you know, if I wanted to find something on the smallest sub genre, I can probably find 20, 30 pages which deal with it either peripherally or hardcore, which is just, it's amazing. And in some ways it's you know, this is the best time in history to be a science fiction fan, and in other ways it's like one of the worst times, because there is just so much out there that I really don't think people today get the grounding that they did in those days, when, you know, to be a fan meant learning about things that you weren't really interested in simply because you were hungry for more, and there wasn't that much out there to feed you. And so you were a lot more eager to explore other nooks and crannies and areas of fandom. And, you know, nowadays, You don't have to, if you don't want to. You know, if you're a fan of Battlestar Galactica, you never have to move beyond that, because there are just hordes and hordes of people who will just shovel more and more Battlestar Galactica stuff at you till you can't hold no more. And you know, it's an embarrassment of riches. Yeah, it's so strange to think back to those days, those early fan days. That was back during the Carter administration, when the nation was trapped in malaise. This was the other thing, by the way, the Carter malaise, that's one of the explanations for the incredible success of Star Wars, because back in the mid-70s, a movie that had a happy ending was not normal. You know, when you would watch a movie like... just any movie, it seemed like downer endings ever since Easy Rider had kind of, and I hope I'm not spoiling Easy Rider for anybody who hasn't seen it, but ever since those guys got shot at the end of Easy Rider, it was like Hollywood just jumped on this bandwagon of having every movie end crappily, except for Jaws. Jaws managed to have the upbeat ending, but that was, you know, Spielberg, before Spielberg did Jaws and managed to kill off the shark. You know, he did the Sugar Land Express, and the people get killed at the end of the... And not to spoil the Sugar Land Express for you guys, but they die at the end of... And not to spoil these other movies, but, you know, the guys don't get away in Capricorn 1. The wife gets taken over by the robot in Stepford Wives. You know, the Satanists win in Rosemary's Baby. It was just a really bad time to be going to movies and expect any kind of happy ending. And then Star Wars comes along and proves that, you know, if you have a movie with a happy ending, it's not corny, it's fun. And then the next thing you know, the happy ending became the formula again. It was literally like one movie. That one movie just turned it all around. I remember back in those days, they used to have a show. You had The Tonight Show, and then after The Tonight Show came The Tomorrow Show. Tonight and then Tomorrow. The Tomorrow Show starred a guy named Tom Snyder, who was incredibly dry and boring. And then this show was really weird, because it was nothing like The Tonight Show. You know, The Tonight Show, you had Johnny and Ed McMahon and Doc Severinsen and the orchestra and the big studio audience all cheering, and then it would go to Tom Snyder, and he's in this little studio in New York. It was like this empty studio with two or three chairs facing each other in this dark room, almost like a black netherworld, like they're just floating out there in space somewhere. And they would kind of talk in hushed voices, and then Tom Snyder, every now and then, you know, he'd be talking, and he'd turn around to the crew and you know, he would occasionally have fun. But I remember one time seeing a show where they'd gathered a whole bunch of experts on vampire lore, and there was a guy who was talking about, you know, vampires as sexual metaphors, and then there was another show where they had Ralph Bakshi promoting his film Coonskin, which was getting just lambasted at the time, hit by racial protests, because, you know, it's a movie called Coonskin, do the math. And so he was on this publicity tour to try to get people to stop judging the movie just on the title, which, you know, wasn't going to help, because you know, if you've ever seen the movie, which you still can, you can get it. It's just not called Coonskin anymore. Now it's on video, on home video, under the title Street Fight. But, you know, it's not really that great a movie. But he was on with psychic Uri Geller, who was telling people to bring watches. You know, at first he bent a fork or a spoon. He bent a spoon, and then he's telling people to bring broken watches to the TV screen, and he was going to help them focus their own psychic energies on fixing those watches, because, you know, the best way to sell people a load of crap and to get them on your side is to somehow convince them that you know, your success is because they're so special, you know, that you getting what you want is because they're so special. And so I think that was one of the reasons why when people started debunking Uri Geller, other people kind of jumped to his defense, because not only did Uri Geller being a fake mean that they had been conned, but it also meant that they didn't have those super special extrasensory powers that Uri told them they had. Because Uri Geller's shtick was, you know, it wasn't, you know, like the old days, that he was, you know, the scion of some incredible powerful family and you know, had this family secret that only he could do. No, his whole thing was, you know, everybody could do this. I've just learned how, which you know, makes everybody special, everybody in his audience. And that was just a brilliant psychological trick to get people on your side. Anyway, one night I found out that they were going to have on the Tomorrow Show, they were going to have the entire cast of Star Trek, and I asked my mom if I could stay up and watch it, because it was a school night, and she said no, of course, because it was a school night. We didn't have a videotape recorder, so I couldn't set a timer to tape it, and so I set my alarm to go off at midnight so I could wake up and watch this show, and that didn't go over too well, because the alarm woke my mom up too, and so she came in and made me turn the TV back off, and that was a pretty bad deal. But it just gives you a sense of the, you know, the lengths we had to go to feed this hunger, because, you know, because I didn't see the show that night, I didn't have videotape, and so, you know, I never got to see it. It's just gone forever. Although I'll bet now, if I were to get onto Google, as a matter of fact, let me fire up the Secret Labs satellite uplink here, and then let's make a check of Google and see what happens. Tomorrow, Tom Snyder, DeForest Kelly. And who else was on it? James Doohan, I think, was on there too. James Doohan. Now watch, I'll probably get like a BitTorrent or something. Yeah, here it is. Blam! Here is part one of The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder, with three cast members of the original Star Trek. James Doohan, the late DeForest Kelly, and Walter Koenig. Also joining Tom are Harlan Ellison and Al Schuster. And this was July 30th, 1976, and this was the show I did not get to see because my mom, and now I can just, bloop, I click on, I fire up the Secret Lab satellite uplink, I do a quick Google search on some names, and the next thing you know, it's there. How cool is that? Okay, so, you know what? I'm going to watch this. So you guys are going to have to step out of this Secret Lab until next time, if there is a next time, because this is, you know, a pod test cast. So, if you have any ideas for things you want to talk about, let me know. And I will see you next time. Thank you.
Tom Snyder next. Good morning, everybody. We conclude our encore presentations for this vacation week for the Tomorrow Show staff, the People Team. It turns out, giant program after giant program. And what a show we have tonight. Not here, but as soon as we finish. Seriously, we have a great show tonight that looks back to the golden days of Star Trek. To this very day, there are hundreds of thousands of people across the country who are not ashamed to call themselves Trekkies.